May it please the Court, I'm David Kolker, representing the Federal Election Commission. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The most important regulation before the Court today is the one defining coordinated communications. Congress itself could not agree on how to define this term and instead gave the Commission enormous discretion to create a definition. Congress did agree upon a minimum content requirement for coordinated communications, and the regulation under review covers far more speech than this minimum requirement.
Let me ask you about statement we made in Chase 2, our first opinion here.
Yes.
On this issue. We said that under the rules that were at issue there, more than 120 days before the election or the primary, quote, a candidate may sit down with a well-heeled supporter and say, why don't you run some ads about my record on tax cuts? The two may even sign a written agreement providing for such ads. Yet so long as a supporter neither recycles campaign materials nor employs the magic words, the ads won't qualify as contributions under FECA, right?
That's correct,
now,
Your Honor.
I didn't see any response to that from the Commission or in your brief.
Well,
is that because you think you've solved that problem?
I think the Commission did respond as a general matter because it looked at the data.
Well, but my question is, could this still happen under the Commission's current regulations that are under issue?
This could still happen, but what the Commission did in this rulemaking is to get data. It looked at data over 500,000 airings.
The data shows, as I read it, the data shows that there are at least about 10% of ads of this kind occur prior to the two windows. That's true even under the Commission's data.
No, Your Honor, that's not consistent.
That's not true?
No, the data show that under the way the regulation is currently structured, 99% of the ads that were looked at from the 2004 election cycle for the presidential race would be picked up beginning 120 days.
In that database, but the record is full of additional examples of pre-window ads that don't use magic words, right?
Well, it is true that the plaintiff submitted a couple of hundred examples from radio and print as well as television. But the point is that it's hypothetical whether there's a problem about coordination. They were asked at the hearing, has there been any evidence that early ads have been coordinated? And the answer was no.
Well, how would anybody know, since under the Commission's existing regulations, as long as they didn't use magic words, there was no reason to report them?
Well, there's simply no evidence that this has been abused. If such behavior is legal, then there'd be no reason for people to hide it. And yet, no one could come forward and show that there has been any abuse, that any of these ads that were pointed to had been, in fact, coordinated. There was no evidence of that. And the Commission was trying to draw a bright line where it is picking up the overwhelming majority of ads 90 days before House and Senate races for primaries and general elections.
When you said overwhelming majority, a minute ago you said 99%. I thought the district court said it was 8.56% of the House ads and 8.44% of the presidential ads were outside the window.
Well, I think with the presidential ads, it depends what the denominator is. If you start all the way from 120 days before the primary and continue and use as the denominator all ads run through the general election, I believe it picks up 99%. With the House and Senate, the Senate figure is much closer to 99%. It was the House figure only where you see the 8% number. And in terms of dollars, it was closer to 3 or 4% of the actual spending.
Why does the percent matter if it's hundreds of thousands of dollars of ads? Why does it matter what percentage it is?
Well, the Commission was trying to draw bright lines that people could understand that would pick up the substantial majority of the ads, and it did that.
And the question we're asking, nobody's questioning the validity of a bright line test. The question is it drawn in the right place? That's the question, right?
Well, clearly the line is drawn in a very reasonable place because of the overwhelming majority of the ads that are picked up.
But if the bright line allows a substantial amount of ads that support, that allow the use of soft money to support a candidate. Doesn't that raise a question as to whether the line is drawn in the right place?
Well, Your Honor, I think we need to go back to congressional intent here, because there seems to be a presumption that the commission was under an obligation to regulate as much speech as possible. The commission...
No, that wasn't my question.
Well, I think...
I mean, the statute prohibits soft money from being used in federal election campaigns. That's the issue, right?
Well, Your Honor, what we're...
And if the commission's regulation permits a substantial amount of soft money, although it may be a small percentage, it's still substantial. How can that be consistent with the goals of the statute?
Well, I think the goals of the statute, generally spoken, need to be looked at specifically about what Congress mandated here. Congress did not require that anything be regulated as a coordinated communication other than coordinated electioneering communications. Congress specifically rejected...
Wait, didn't it require that expenditures made, I'm quoting from the statute, expenditures made by any person in cooperation, consultation, or concert with or at the request or suggestion of a candidate, et cetera, is all regarded as a coordinated expenditure.
Yes, but expenditure has different meanings in different contexts.
And it defined expenditure as, quote, any purchase, payment, distribution for the purpose of influencing any election.
But the term expenditure has been differently construed in different contexts. In terms of independent expenditures, the court has narrowed it to express advocacy. In the days before this regulation, the commission had an electioneering message
test. But we're talking about coordinated expenditures, not independent expenditures.
Yes, but Congress was well aware.
That's a different issue.
Well, the issue, Your Honor, is that Congress was well aware that expenditure had been interpreted differently in different contexts. And as BCRA was progressing through the House and the Senate, Congress specifically rejected a proposal that would have eliminated express advocacy as a touchstone for deciding when a coordinated communication would count as a coordinated expenditure. We have an explicit rejection of the idea that the commission could not use express advocacy.
What if you have an agreement published in the New York Times, which says, we agree for the purpose of influencing this election that we will make millions of dollars worth of expenditures on behalf of client X more than 120 days before. We're going to act together in cooperation, consultation, and concert, and our purpose is to influence the election. Now, would that not be, that won't be covered, right?
If it avoids express advocacy or republication of campaign materials, no.
Right.
But if evidence like that were to come to the commission's attention, it could rethink this.
Well, it could rethink it, but in the individual case, it would be too late, right? Because it had issued a rule saying that this is outside the rule. So if there were an agreement between a presidential candidate and somebody who has $1 billion, and the agreement were published on the front page of the New York Times, that agreement could not be stopped and could not be punished, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. But
that's consistent with the statute?
Yes, because Congress only required that electioneering communications, when coordinated, would have to be treated as coordinated communications. What the commission has done is completely consistent with congressional directive. The commission expanded these minimum criteria. Congress only said if it's 60 days before a general election or 30 days before a primary election, and it mentioned a federal candidate, would it have to be considered a coordinated communication?
That's whether it would have to be considered. Here I'm suggesting one in which everybody agrees that it is. Not one that you have to infer, not one that you have to take from circumstantial evidence.
But the congressional directive was not to regulate as much speech as possible. The congressional directive...
No, there's a big difference between regulating as much speech as possible and regulating something that it is an avowed agreement to influence the election.
Well, Congress has continued to rely upon the express advocacy standard in non-broadcast media 21 months out of every two-year election cycle. The lines that the commission has drawn here are completely consistent with that congressional intent.
You're worried about regulating speech, right?
Yes.
Well, you know, suppose, I'm not suggesting this is the right one, but suppose the commission, instead of using the magic words test, use the promotes, attacks, supports, or opposes standard, which McConnell sustained. That would capture much more, but yet wouldn't interfere with free speech.
Well, that very well may be a reasonable interpretation. The commission did consider that in the NPRM, and it ultimately decided that in this area that it wanted to draw a brighter line. This court in Orlowski...
Is that line any less bright than this line?
Well, I think promote, attack, support, or oppose...
The Supreme Court has already sustained it.
Well, we would like to think so, Your Honor, but it only discussed it briefly in terms of federal election activity with regard to political committees. So we're not exactly sure where the Supreme Court stands on that standard in all contexts. And in the Orlowski decision, this court upheld the commission's reliance on an express advocacy standard, admittedly drawing a line between corporate support for candidates.
That supports the use of a bright line. It doesn't tell us whether the line's in the right place or whether the standard's the right standard.
Well, Orlowski, if I may, Your Honor, Orlowski specifically upheld the commission's use of express advocacy and specifically upheld the commission, even though it recognized that this was a line drawn in a place that would be quite favorable to the regulated community. And under that precedent, the same result should come out here.
I want to ask you a question about the former employee and vendor issue.
Sure.
The Shays brief says, the rule would allow top staffers to leave a campaign, wait 120 days, and then run expenditures for a seemingly independent group using all their campaign knowledge. Is that accurate?
Well, I think it would depend what else was going on in terms of whether there was back and forth communication. But it is true that the 120 days is the overlap period that can't happen with this regulation.
But after the 120 days, as the brief says, they could, quote, use all their campaign knowledge, right?
Yes, the commission.
For a seemingly independent group.
Yes, the commission determined that that was a reasonable way to accommodate the interest that it was looking at, that there had been testimony about the chilling effect of using the entire election cycle, particularly for the six-year Senate races, and wanted to have something that was more realistic.
This is true even in the words of the regulation, even if it's material, right? Even if it's material information, it can be shared or used.
Yes, but
what does material mean in that sense?
Material has not been further defined by regulation, Your Honor. It will be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
Well, I take it material is material to the ability to coordinate expenditures. That's the point of the regulation.
Well, I think it would be material to the nature of the expenditure that was going to be made.
Right. And that's expressly permitted outside the window.
Yes. The commission, in its judgment, the commission found that in general, that campaign information, tactics, and strategies get stale pretty quickly. It made an analogy to its polling data where between 60 and 180 days it loses almost all of its value and tried.
Right. I'm looking at the situation where they published in the New York Times an advertisement saying we are going to, the time is up. We actually have material information and now we're going to use it. I appreciate that it may not always be useful, but in this case it is useful and we're going to use it because it's okay under the rule. It is okay.
Again, this is hypothetical, Your Honor. There was no such evidence before the commission that this was going to have this kind of abuse. And the commission
made... even if you could prove material information, that wouldn't matter.
If the rest of it is met in terms of it's a common vendor, but there's no active discussion anymore...
Right. Anymore, right.
Yes, that's how the rule operates. Your Honor, if I...
could ask you one question about the voter registration and the get-out-the-vote activity. So, under the regulation, can they spend as much as they want on robocalls directed only to a particular party?
It would depend upon what the calls say, Your Honor.
Get out and vote. This is the Democratic Party of, as in the advisory opinion, this is the Democratic Party of, somewhere in California. We'd like, here's the script, right? Hi, I'm the chair of the L.A. County Democratic Party. It's important for registered, I have an important message for registered Democrats. Election day is Tuesday, June 6th. Get out and vote. That's all. Let's say that's all they say.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know how the commission would view that as get out the vote drive. It may very well be, but it sounds as if it doesn't really matter because that would be generic party activity. and it would be covered as federal election activity under a different provision. A lot of what's going on.
So if they didn't mention, I understand what you're saying. If they didn't mention the party at all, but they only directed the calls to registered Democrats.
I don't know how the commission would come out on that, Your Honor. I would invite you to look at the example that the other side has made so much about at 412 in the appendix, because I think it clearly, when you read it, it's about local party activity. There's a bare mention of Election Day, but it's all about a mayoral race, and it just is not about federal election activity.
Well, are you talking about the advisory opinion?
Yes.
So it has a sentence that says, the proposed pre-recorded electronically dialed telephone calls are the functional equivalent of a form letter and similarly do not provide any individualized information to any particular recipient. Thus, the planned communications are generic in nature and do not provide any individualized assistance to voters. That seems quite clear.
Yes, but remember, this was just one advisory opinion, depending upon the nature of the message.
Would there be anything else to go on with respect to the commission's view about this?
I don't believe there have been any other advisory opinions. I think the regulation makes it clear that the list of activities that counts as get-out-the-vote activity and voter registration activity is non-exhaustive.
So and would it be unreasonable if this were imagine this were their rule, the FEC's rule, that you can spend as much as you want on robocalls aimed directly at getting out the vote of a particular party, and that doesn't count as get-out-the-vote activity?
But it may very well. It would depend upon the facts, Your Honor.
Well, I'm asking you the facts. Imagine the facts are as I just described. A lot of money, robocalls aimed only at one party. It's registered members. That's it. Those are the only facts.
But it would depend what the message says.
Get out and vote.
If it just said get out and
vote.
Yeah,
there's an election on Tuesday. Be sure to vote.
It might, Your Honor.
It might what?
The commission might find that that is.
Is
federal election activity.
What if they found that it wasn't? Would that be unreasonable?
Probably not. Because
why not?
Because there's nothing individualized about it. The commission was trying to draw a line where traditionally get-out-the-vote activity is something where you're actually helping an individual get out to vote. And a completely generic
call. Everything turns then on whether the commission's use of individualized is reasonable or not. That word is not in the statute, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Curtis, and I represent the appellee, Christopher Shays. I can't help but note that the last case before the court involved questions about significant delay going back to the late 1990s. We're not quite there yet, but it should be underscored that we are now in the fourth election cycle since BCRA was enacted in early 2002, we still don't have adequate, meaningful coordination, content regulations, or regulations with respect to a number of other issues. I agree with my friend Mr. Kolker that the coordination content rule is certainly the most important issue before the court, but each of the challenged regulations strikes at the heart of the reforms mandated by Congress. Each is flawed. The state party fundraiser, which is the subject of our cross appeal, I believe fails at Chevron step one.
Before you leave coordinated, could you say something about this debate we were having with Mr. Kolker about what the record reflects about the percentage of ads that are pre 90 or 120 days?
Yes, of course, Your Honor, and I was going to get back to that. As Judge Garland noted, the Commission's own data, CMAQ data, and recall that we think that data is flawed, and in fact the percentages are higher, but even if you just look at the Commission's own data, 8.56% of all House primary ads are run outside of the 90-day window. Judge Garland, there was an interchange about the presidential primary ads. Mr. Kolker suggested that we're really only talking about 1% or less. That's not accurate. Referring to the commission's graph P7, which appears at administrative record page 2197, this shows, under the commission's data, that 8.44% of the presidential primary ads are run outside of the 120-day window. Now, if you aggregate everything, including the general election, the percentage may well go down. But if you are just looking at pre-primary, pre-caucus ads, nearly 9% of all of those ads in 2004 fell outside of the window. According to the commission, that translated to some $800,000 of effectively unregulated spending under these rules. And remember, that $800,000 number only reflects 23 DMAs, designated marketing areas. There are over 100 DMAs that CMAG monitors. And of course, CMAG doesn't get a number of other TV stations or any radio, newsprint, and so forth. So it doesn't take much of a stretch extrapolating from that to see that the amount of presidential primary spending that would escape the window easily runs into the millions of dollars. Judge Tatel, you noted that there were a number of other examples in the record. The commission calls them anecdotal. I don't believe there's anything anecdotal about them. These are some 200 examples, case studies that focus on the last three presidential election cycles and the 2004 and 2006 cycles. And those data confirm, really, the CMAG data, that there are numerous instances in which candidates perceive real value and spend their own money on early advertising. And I'm not talking about 121 days or 122 days before the election. I'm talking about documented instances of 6 months before the primary, 12 months before the primary, even further than that. For example, there's an example in the record, and this comes from the commission's own audit data, that in 1996, President Clinton spent $2.3 million of his own money. I'm not talking about coordinated spending with the DNC. I'm talking about $2.3 million of the president's own campaign's own hard money in June and July of 1995, almost a year and a half out from the general election, on issue ads, exactly the sort of issue ads you wrote about last time, Judge Tatel. And it's notable, you ask in your opinion, does this ever have any effect on an election? I think it's notable that the president's media advisor, Dick Morris, in his memoirs, as we note in our brief, said that the key to the president's reelection was the early advertising that began in June of 1995.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second? Unfortunately, you've raised in my mind the question that was mentioned in the FEC's footnote. So what's the standing with respect to the plaintiffs here to object to the presidential window?
Sure, Your Honor. Let me note, if I can, that it's unfortunate that the commission chose to wait until it's a footnote in its reply brief to raise that issue. The commission, all throughout this case, has simply rested on its earlier standing objections without raising any new objections. This wasn't raised in the district court, wasn't raised in the early briefing, but it seems to me Shays has standing in at least two respects. One, I would contend that what happens at the presidential level, what happens at the top of the ticket, certainly often has an impact down ticket in Senate and House races, so that the court standard is an illegal structuring of the competitive environment in which Shays seeks re-election. That illegal structuring at the top of the ticket certainly can have effects below. But there's another separate issue. And that's informational standing.
There's no affidavits on that subject, right? Because it wasn't raised below. I take it there are no affidavits on this sort of cascading effect that you're talking about.
No, on that precise issue, Representative Shays did not address the down ticket effect. But what he did address was second ground for standing, informational standing, which was briefed to this court last time around. The court chose not to address that issue because it didn't need to. Representative Shays raised informational standing in his complaint, which is at JA 18, paragraph 13, in his declaration at paragraph 8, in his statement of proposed facts, paragraph 23, at JA 449. It seems to me this is a classic instance of informational standing under Aikens. If a coordinated expenditure is not captured, is not treated as a contribution, then all of the disclosure requirements that apply to contributions go out the window. And of course, under Aikens, standing is not limited simply to candidates, parties, or so forth, but extends all the way to voters. Representative Shays has raised his standing as a voter, as a citizen, as a party member, as an elected official, and as a candidate. And in all of those respects, it seems to me, Judge Garland, he has a clear interest, in self-evident interest, in obtaining information about campaign-related contributions and expenditures. This isn't a case like other cases the court has addressed before, where the information would be duplicative or merely a trifle, or where Shays is really seeking punishment or something else and not information. We're talking about outright disclosure. So it seems to me Shays has standing in both.
Could I ask you to return to the argument you were about to make about the state party fundraisers? You were making a Chevron argument about the state party fundraisers, I think, a couple minutes ago.
Sure, Your Honor. Why, as to why I think this fails
right.
under Chevron?
Right, right.
I think it fails under, most clearly under Chevron Step 1, because this construction contravenes the plain language and structure and purposes and legislative history of the soft money provisions. Let me give you a couple of examples. Section 441I uses the word solicit 17 times. It is a term of very precise art.
So what do you think Congress intended? I mean, they were clearly allowing federal office holders to appear at, to speak at, and to be featured speakers at state party fundraising events. So you don't think that creates any sense of ambiguity about what they were like? What is Congress anticipating they could and could not do at those events?
I think Congress recognized that in the absence of such a provision, there may well be ambiguity because, for example, someone could make an argument that, well, you showed up at the fundraiser and you're lending your good name to these efforts, and it doesn't that constitute solicitation? Congress wanted to make sure, felt so strongly about the need for federal candidates to attend state party fundraisers that it wanted to clarify.
Attend and speak and be a featured speaker at, right?
Yes, but not to solicit. Congress, well, Your Honor.
What does that mean? Not to solicit. They can come there and give a speech, but just not use magic words? I thought you were on the other side of the magic word sort of construct.
Well, what it means, Your Honor, would be, for example, first of all, let me emphasize, a federal candidate can go to a state party fundraiser and may solicit money within FECA's right. Contribution limits and source prohibitions. So that can happen. But there's no indication that Congress intended to blow a hole in the solicitation ban, which otherwise is nearly absolute.
So they can speak at the fundraiser as long as they don't say, give us money?
Well,
if the office holder gives a speech about the greatness of the American Republic and at the end of the speech says, and you know, while you're here, put your money in the hat that's going around, that would be forbidden?
Yes, in the absence of a further disclosure. It's perfectly fine for the federal candidate if he wants to say, and please dig deep and give money. But as the commission has held in a number of other examples, All the federal candidate has to do is give a disclosure. Listen, I can't solicit corporate or union funds, and I can't ask you to give more than a certain amount, and let's be clear. But within those limits, please support the party. Now, the commission has used exactly that approach with respect to state candidate fundraisers, PAC fundraisers, and there's no reason why that same approach couldn't be used here. Going back to my point about solicitation, Congress has a broad ban, absolute ban. No federal office holder or candidate shall solicit, period. There are then three express exceptions that say you may solicit in this instance, that instance, and so forth, subject to very tightly constrained restraints. Again, in the state party fundraiser situation, the word solicit doesn't appear. If Congress had wanted to authorize solicitation, it would have. As
the nature, the very nature of the event is to raise money, right?
I agree, Your Honor, and there could therefore be some ambiguity there. And that's why Congress wanted to make clear that a candidate could show up, attend, speak.
And so your argument is when they say speak and not saying solicit, that Congress is clarifying the circumstance so that since they don't use the word solicit there, that they can't do that.
You can give a speech, but you can't solicit. Now both the commission and the district court reasoned that Congress should have spelled out. You know, if Congress intended to prohibit solicitation by a federal candidate of soft money at that event, then it should have said you can attend, speak, be a featured guest, but you may not solicit. And the district court agreed with that reasoning. But as this court said in Shays 1, Congress is not required to rule out every possibility in order for language to be clear. And a statute is not ambiguous simply because it doesn't expressly negate the agency's reading. I think the approach to the state party fundraiser ought to be very similar to, Judge Tatel, your analysis on the definition of solicit. And what you said there was that in rejecting a very narrow definition of solicit, that given Congress's manifest purpose to shut down the soft money system, it would be absurd, your word, and would fly in the face of this purpose to promulgate a regulation that allows parties and politicians to perpetuate soft money fundraising by federal politicians, albeit in more circumscribed circumstances. I think that analysis is precisely on point here.
I wanted to ask you a question about the former employee and the common vendor question.
Yes, Your Honor.
The commission found that this kind of information, quote, doesn't remain material for long periods of time, and that national or local events tend to render campaign events and strategies obsolete. The commission's an expert agency. Why should we defer to that judgment about the effect of this information?
You should not defer to that, Your Honor, for many reasons. Uh-huh. First of all, the commission didn't find that inside information, material information, automatically becomes obsolete after 120 days. What it said in the E&J was that material information tends to have a short life. Much of the information becomes largely irrelevant. So it itself recognized that there could be some exceptions to that. Two, in support of that conclusion, the commission pointed to only two sources, the polling regulations and Congress's revolving door rules. The problem with those, of course, is that the revolving door rules apply for a full year after leaving employment, and the polling regulations recognize that even polling data, which I think we can agree tends to have a fairly short life, even polling data can retain value for up to 180 days. If you examine the sort of information covered by the former vendor rule, you'll see that it's not simply fundraising. There are things like voter lists, mailing lists, donor lists. I have a hard time seeing how a donor list becomes stale after 120 days. The district court offered the example of a comprehensive 50-state media a strategy, campaign master plan. That could well retain a value for more than 120 days. But I guess finally, Judge Tatel, the regulation as it is written assumes that the information is material and non-public. If the information has already become public, there is a safe harbor in this regulation. Public information isn't covered. And if the information becomes stale, we're not going to have a problem anyway because it's no longer material. So we're only talking about information that is not public and that has not become stale. And as we argued in our briefs, this rule operates to affirmatively authorize former operatives to pass along material inside information after only 180 days. But might I address the Orlowski point in 30 seconds?
30
or
seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. My friend Mr. Kolker pointed to Orlowski as support for his position, but I think it needs to be emphasized that this court said that express advocacy in that context was okay only in this limited context, and that there was no potential for gross abuse, and that the type of activity at issue led the corporate sponsorship of legislative picnics and meetings offered only a limited opportunity to give any significant financial support. As you recall, there it was hamburgers and potato salad, but only a limited opportunity to give any significant financial support. And this court said that even that was at the outer bounds of the of permissible choice. The opposite's true here. Here we're talking about a rule that authorizes potentially the expenditure of millions of dollars.
On a different topic, on the firewall issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'm having a little difficulty understanding exactly the nature of your objection there. Part of that objection is it's not specific enough, not detailed enough. Is that right?
Yes, very much, Your Honor. It seems to me there are really three principal objections. Lack of any standards, unexplained change in course from the last rulemaking when the commission rejected the use of firewalls, and an impermissible attempt to accommodate political operatives at the expense of statutory goals. Let me address the lack of any standards because I hoped I had the opportunity to raise your opinion in cement kiln with you, Judge Garland. The commission points to a cement kiln for the proposition that it has broad discretion in defining the level of detail. And we agree that it has discretion, but the reg at issue in cement kiln, as the court emphasized, offered considerable detail about what had to be done, set forth various factors that had to be...
Let me ask you this question. In your law firm, you must have many lawyers who were in the federal government at one point, right?
Yes, we do.
And it's against the law, it's a crime for somebody who is in the federal government to participate in private practice in a matter in which he personally and substantially participated in the government, right? And the way you solve that problem is with a firewall.
Yes.
Right? And both in the case with respect to the DC bar rules and the ABA rules, the entire regulation is about a paragraph long. Basically says you got to set up a screen and you have to file affidavits saying that you have this screen. And that's all there is to it. Now, why is this any different? That's basically what they've done here. They've said that you have to have a firewall that prevents specific, information from passing, and you have to have in advance a description of the written policy. If that's good enough to prevent one of your partners from committing a federal crime, why isn't that good enough here for somebody in this situation for the same?
Seems to me, Your Honor, well, as the commission explained 3 years ago, or I'm sorry, the first time in 2003, simply having an ethical screen is not enough and invites circumvention without some mechanism to ensure enforcement in the screen. So the commission had a great distrust of ethical screens absent enforcement.
You could say the same thing with respect to people coming out of the government and then being in a law firm with people who are on the other side. They have a screen here. It requires that there be a screen. Safe harbor doesn't apply if specific information indicates that information is passing across the screen. It has to be designed to prohibit the flow of information, and it must be described in a written policy. I really don't see how that's any different than what prevents your law firm from committing a crime. Every time the money that you earn, for example, today, goes to somebody who worked in the FEC yesterday or 5 days ago.
Well, for one reason, Judge Garland, it seems to me that when my firm has a screen, we still bear the burden of demonstrating that we haven't committed an ethical violation. The burden remains upon us. Here,
we don't actually know that. I mean, we don't know whether you actually have the burden or the other side has the burden. That would only come about in a criminal case, and which somebody would try to, or in a civil case. I don't know there are any case law on this. Does the commission specifically say where the burden is here?
If
it just says has to be specific information.
Yes, then the complainant must come forward with specific information demonstrating that information.
But it doesn't say how much of a burden that is. I mean, obviously,
there has to be somebody
have the burden of going forward, right? Specific information could be just the typical prima facie case or the production burden of going forward. You wouldn't object to that, would you? I mean, if you have absolutely no reason to suspect, if there is no information of any quality suggesting a firewall has been breached, then would you object to that kind of a rule?
It seems to me, yes, Your Honor, because it seems to me that simply for a company to say, we have a firewall and we've passed out the written policy, does not go far enough and does not offer sufficient
detail. You think bar counsel could just come up to your firm and say, you know, I have absolutely no reason to suspect that your law firm's firewall is no good, but hey, you know what, I'd just like to see your firewall. And I want to depose a bunch of people to find out, and you're going to have to prove to me that you actually have this. I think that they could do that. You wouldn't object to an investigation for which there was no specific information to begin the investigation?
To prove that the firewall worked?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's entirely reasonable for a firm to have to demonstrate that it not only has a firewall, but that it was applied and
even if there's no specific information to suggest otherwise. I mean, normally these things have to come up, unless the idea here is we're going to investigate this in every case. Somebody has to have some reason, whether you describe that reason as probable cause or prima facie or something. And I don't, maybe I missed it, but I don't see anything in either the regulation or the discussion which says what the nature of this burden of proof is. Did I miss something? Is there, when you say burden of proof, that all relies on that language specific information. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. May I just point out, I would urge the court to take a look at its MST Express decision, which you discussed in your cement kiln case, because there the guidance that was challenged in an issue said simply that motor carriers had to demonstrate that they had, quote, adequate controls in place which functioned effectively to ensure acceptable compliance. And this court struck it down and said that's not sufficient. More detail and guidance is necessary. Thank you, Your Honors.
Does Mr. Colbert have any time? We took Mr. Curtis way over his time, so Mr. Colbert, you can take 4 minutes if you will.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to briefly address the state party fundraiser issue and the firewall issue. I think in terms of the state party fundraisers, here we have a very, very specific congressional indication that there's something unique about federal office holders.
Why didn't they use solicit? They use it elsewhere in the statute. They know how to use language to prohibit solicitations.
Well,
they didn't use that here. They used speak.
They didn't. But elsewhere in the provision about soft money fundraising, they did use the word solicit. And what the commission was trying to do was to give meaning to this special fundraiser provision. I think it's a little bit of a misconception to say that BCRA eliminated soft money fundraising by federal candidates. It did eliminate it for federal candidates raising soft money for the national political parties. But for state and local parties, federal candidates can raise up to $10,000 a year from individuals for the state and local parties' non-federal accounts. And that is an exception built into the statute before we even get to the special provision about state party fundraisers. And all that the commission was trying to do was to give meaning to this state party fundraiser provision above and beyond the fact that federal office holders could already solicit up to $10,000 for these state or local parties. And as Judge Griffith, as you pointed out before, the whole nature of this event is a fundraiser. In most cases, people have paid their money before they get in. That's their contribution. The idea that we're going to parse the speech of a federal candidate who's already allowed to solicit up to $10,000 when the statute specifically says they can speak and be the featured guest at these events, so as to not render that provision superfluous, the commission simply reasoned that we're going to let them speak in this very limited context without restriction. It's not about what they say before the event or after the event. They can't be signing solicitation letters before the event, but while they're there at the state party fundraiser, they are allowed to speak without restriction. With regard to the firewall, I think the regulation.
Before you get to the firewall, would you mind, on the standing question, you have a response to their point? Your footnote was you were just raising it for the benefit of the court. We appreciate that. But with respect to the two arguments they gave on presidential standing?
Well, I think the top-down argument is novel, but far too attenuated.
Well, is it the commission's position that they lack standing?
Yes.
It is?
Yes.
Because your footnote said may.
Well,
I didn't get that from the footnote.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. We just wanted to use our brief time without getting into a long argument, given the decision in Shays 1. But we did want to raise it with the court and preserve it for the future. But the top-down argument doesn't make a lot of sense to me, given that he just doesn't compete at all in the presidential situation.
What about the Aikens argument?
Well, I would say that simply is irrelevant as to the whatever limits you would have on coordinated expenditures. In other words, if what you're talking about is only being allowed to spend up to the contribution limits on these coordinated communications, that's a contribution limit. And that's not about Aikens. Aikens is about.
I thought their argument was that anything outside the 120 days is essentially not regulated, that is, except with respect to the republication standard. Their view is that and things outside the 120 days should be regulated, and if they're regulated, they have to be reported.
Yes, and what I'm saying is the regulation comes into two pieces. One is its regulation, coordinated expenditures would be regulated as contribution limits and subject to the
disclosure.
Say, $2,300 cap if it's made.
Also subject to disclosure if
yes.
It went over.
And what I'm saying is, while it's possible, I haven't had a chance to think about it, while it's possible they might have standing about the coordinated communication being reported, that wouldn't give them standing to challenge across the board the contribution.
Well, wouldn't the definition, the definition has two effects, reporting and limits. What they're attacking is the definition.
Yes, and to that extent, I guess they may have standing in terms of how it would play out on the information side. Just finally on the firewall, I think the Commission's regulation is very clear, especially in its explanation and justification, that in an enforcement context, the Commission will weigh the credibility and specificity of any allegation of coordination against the credibility and specificity of the facts presented about the firewall. And if there is a specific indication that material information has passed through the firewall, it will not protect the organization. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.